You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 18, given in Dornach on April 7th, 1920. I believe that our scientific medical education truly needs an infusion of what might be called a return to the true causes of pathological phenomena. In recent times, the tendency has become ever more pronounced to disregard actual causes and to look at surface occurrences. A phenomenon related to this superficiality is the fact that whenever we begin to read or hear a description of any type of illness, current medicine or pathology almost always informs us about what has invaded the human organism, about what kind of bacillus provokes the illness in question. It is terribly easy, of course, to repudiate any objections to the idea of lower organisms invading the body for the simple reason that it is no longer necessary to first prove that these lower organisms are present. Since distinct forms of microorganisms are indeed evident in different illnesses, the tendency to suggest a connection is quite understandable. But even on a superficial level, this view gives rise to an error that actually completely distracts us from the main issue. If bacilli appear in large numbers in a certain part of the body in the course of an illness, they naturally provoke symptoms, as do any foreign bodies in the organism. As a result of the presence of these bacilli, all kinds of inflammations appear. But if we then attribute everything to the activity of the bacilli, directing our attention only to what the bacilli are doing, we are distracted from the true cause of the disease, because any habitat that lower organisms find suitable for their own development within the human body is brought about by the primary causes. For once, we need to pay attention to the domain of primary causes. In order to do so, we must briefly turn our attention again to modes of observation that we have already begun to use. Consider once again the plants that cover the surface of the earth, the sum total of the earth's vegetation. We must be clear that the vegetation, growing up out of the earth toward cosmic space, is not simply sent forth by the earth. It is also pulled upward by forces that are just as much a part of plant growth as the forces working into it from out of the earth. In plants, there is a constant interaction between the earth's forces and the forces of the supra-earthly cosmos. What is the effect of these non-earthly forces, which are always present in our environment? If these forces that work in from the cosmos came to full expression and took hold of the plants totally, that is, if the planets did not ensure that these forces could also withdraw, plants would have the tendency to turn into animals, as they went on growing from the stem toward the flower and the seed. The tendency to turn into animals is always present. What works in from the cosmos is counteracted by the tendency that works out of the earth, the tendency to suppress plant existence and to become mineral within the plant kingdom. What I am drawing your attention to here is the fact that plant existence as such holds the balance between the tendency toward mineralization or salt deposition in plant tissue and the tendency toward inflammation or becoming animal-like. This process is always present in outer nature, but it is also present in an internalized and centralized form in the human organism. Because it possesses lungs, the human organism is a real little earth, and everything that works out of the lungs works downward in the same way that the forces that work from the earth out into the plant organism work upward. The effect of everything that works via respiration and cardiac activity to counter the internal metabolism of the lungs and so forth is similar to the effect of this cosmic factor out here. And there's a drawing. In a human organism, everything that is concentrated in cardiac activity needs to be kept separate from what is organized and concentrated in the lungs' internal metabolism. These two activities must be kept separate. They can be allowed to affect each other only through an etheric or astral diaphragm inserted between them. At this point, we must raise the question of whether this diaphragm exists, since I am using this word only to suggest an image. Is there a diaphragm that prevents the activity of the head, throat, and lungs from mingling with the activity of the abdomen and chest in any way except through the external rhythm of respiration? Such a diaphragm does indeed exist, and it is the external rhythm of respiration itself. At this point, you begin to see how harmony is achieved between the upper and lower regions of the human being. What we call rhythmical activity in the human being, the rhythmical trembling that is expressed outwardly and physically as respiratory rhythm, extends into the activity of the etheric and astral bodies and separates the earthly forces of the upper part of the human being, which are concentrated in the lungs, and the heavenly forces of the lower part, which work from below upward through the activity expressed in the heart, just as they work from the periphery of the cosmos toward the center of the earth. Imagine that this rhythm is not working properly. The metaphorical diaphragm, which, though not physically present, is created by these rhythms striking against each other, is out of order. What happens then is analogous to what happens when the earth's activity becomes too strong in plants, when earthly salt-forming activity affects the plants too strongly, and they become overly mineralized. What happens then is that an, quote, etheric plant, close quote, which is built into the lungs and grows up out of them, just as physical plants grow up out of the earth, becomes the cause of pulmonary hardening or the like. Here we find that the mineralizing tendency that is present in plants can also become too strong in the human organism. On the other hand, the animalizing tendency can also become too strong. When this happens, it creates a domain in the upper part of the organism that should not be there. The organs of this part of the body become embedded in an etheric domain, as it were, that is favorable to an activity that should not be promoted in the organism, namely, the life of microscopic plants or animals. Where they come from need not concern us, but we do need to be concerned about the creation of the habitat that supports them. This favorable habitat should not be present. Its activity ought to extend throughout the organism rather than becoming a special enclosed domain. When it extends throughout the organism, it supports the life of the entire organism. But when it takes the form of a little enclosed domain, it becomes a life-supporting medium for the microscopic plants or animals whose presence we can confirm in everything that causes illness, or at least in much of what causes illness, in the upper areas of the human being. To solve the riddle of how bacilli influence the human organism, we must return to rhythmical activity and its disturbance, and see whether a special domain is created in place of a general domain extending throughout the organism. Without returning to the spiritual causes, we will never be able to solve this riddle. Exactly the same thing that affects plant life here, above the earth's surface, that is, also affects the outer life of animals and human beings. Like plants, humans and animals are also influenced by certain forces that come from the cosmos above the earth and counteract the forces arising from within. And again, that drawing on page 253. The forces coming from within the earth are localized in certain organs in the upper part of the human being, while the forces streaming in from outside are localized in abdominal organs. Once again, if I may put it in this way, a dividing wall must be erected between their respective activities. Normal regulation of this separation is accomplished by human spleen activity. This is another example of how rhythm is active in the human organism. But this time the rhythm is different from respiratory rhythm, which takes place in little oscillations and runs through the entire life of the human being. If respiratory rhythm is not in order, diseases having exclusively to do with the upper part of the human being will arise. But since digestion extends both downward and upward, it is also possible for diseases that are caused down below to be present in the upper region of the human being. We must distinguish between these two types of illness. We must not think of the human being as divided according to some rigid scheme, because individual systems intermingle. However, there must be a dividing wall between what works from above, as if coming from the earth, and what works from below, as if coming from heavenly space. In fact, our upper regions send their forces out to meet the forces of the lower human being. And in each human individual, the rhythm between the two must be regulated. This rhythm is expressed in the right proportion of waking to sleeping. Each time we wake up is one beat of this rhythm, and each time we fall asleep is another beat. This rhythm of waking, sleeping, incorporates other rhythmical processes, similar peaks that are brought about simply because even in the waking state we are awake in our upper parts, but asleep in our lower parts. The rhythmical activity that is continually taking place between the upper and the lower parts of the human being is caught up in larger rhythms only through the alternation of waking and sleeping. Imagine that a breach occurs in the boundary that consists of this rhythm between the upper and lower parts of the human being. In this case, the activity of the upper part of the human being usually breaks through into the abdomen from above. An etheric breach occurs, and etheric activity that ought to take place only in the upper human body begins to occur in the lower part. Certain finer forces break through. Once again, this results in the creation of a domain that should not be there. Instead of being localized in the abdomen, this domain ought to be distributed throughout the human being. As a result of a breakthrough of this sort, the abdomen is poisoned, in a sense. When upper body activity intervenes in this way, abdominal activity can no longer take place as it should. In addition, however, the new domain that is created here provides a habitat for microorganisms. You might say that a breakthrough from above provokes typhoid fever in the human being, the concomitant phenomenon of the appearance of an abdominally localized milieu creates what the typhus bacillus requires in order to flourish. Here you see a clear separation of primary and secondary factors. This separation will also enable you to see the need to distinguish between the ultimate causes of such an illness and the symptoms of inflammation that appear simply as a consequence of the presence of a whole army of intestinal fauna or flora, especially in the small intestines. All the physical symptoms in the small intestines, including bacilli, including the activity of these plant or animal microorganisms, are simply reactions to upper functions breaking through into the lower functions of the human organism. Again, we need not discuss where these bacilli come from, because they would not be able to lead their animal or vegetable existence there if the right milieu had not been created for them. All these phenomena are mere consequences. The important point is to aim for the primary factor, rather than secondary ones, when we are looking for therapeutic procedures. We will speak more about this later, because we can talk about these matters only once we are in a position to go back to their true origins. This is almost impossible for modern conventional medicine, because it excludes any view that shifts from a material process to a spiritual process. Everything material, however, is underlaid by spirit. You will easily be able to explain the characteristic clinical picture of typhoid fever, for example, if you take a good look at what I have just discussed. Keep in mind that this illness is very often coupled with symptoms of pulmonary mucosal inflammation and disturbances of consciousness. Pulmonary symptoms develop because an activity is withdrawn from the upper part in order to appear down below. Once the breakthrough has taken place, what has appeared in the lower part of the human being is no longer present at all up above. Similarly, the upper organs that are the vehicles of consciousness can no longer work effectively when what is supposed to mediate their activity has penetrated the lower parts of the body. The entire clinical picture of typhoid fever appears before your mind's eye if you really look at this primary cause. Under certain circumstances, this collection of unrelated outer symptoms, something we otherwise always look at only from outside, appears so forcefully in an individual's subconscious that it even becomes possible to paint it on the basis of its existential connections. The urge to objectify it prophetically comes about before it paints itself upon the interior of the organism. Then the person in question feels the urge to record what is slipping away from the upper body as blue spots, and what is slipping away from the abdomen as red spots on canvas. Imagine an individual who feels called upon to be an artist instead of a tailor or a shoemaker, but has little experience in painting techniques. If this person is also robust enough, and this does not require outer robustness, to constantly suppress abdominal illnesses that are attempting to arise within, you can experience how this person objectifies these abdominal illnesses on canvas, rather than allowing them to gain a hold on the body. You can find the products of this strange activity in much of expressionistic painting, where you can see the artist's state of health with regard to the lower body in the red and yellow colors. Try to see everything you find there in blue and purple as a poetic expression of the state of the artist's upper body, of the lungs and everything that accompanies lung activity as it moves rhythmically toward the head. If you take a close look at examples such as this, you will find a remarkable harmony between an individual's general actions and the internal state of his or her organization. From how an individual presents him or herself, you will develop a certain intuition or image of how that person's body is functioning. It is totally false to believe that a person's outer actions and appearance, the sole activity he or she undertakes in the outer world, is dependent only on the nervous system. It depends on the entire human being. It is an image of the entire human being. simply by recalling the childhood appearance of someone condemned to carry all of the damaging consequences of delayed growth over into later stages of life, we can develop intuitive insight that enables us to observe in the child what the intellectual adult of advancing age will be like. What prevents him or her from growing upward makes this person appear ungainly but strong. Whether a child appears heavy or light will allow you to get an intuitive idea of how that child will grow. Numerous similar phenomena point out how the entire gesture of the way a person presents him or herself is nothing more than the interaction of the inner parts of the human organism, an interaction that has been brought into movement. It would be desirable to include such considerations in medical curricula. Just think, the most favorable prerequisites are already present. It is easiest for young people in their early 20s to immerse themselves in such subjects. As soon as we reach our 30s, we lose this gift, and it is no longer so easy to find our way into such matters, although it remains possible to acquire intuitions of this sort through very strict self-education. Certain potentials that persist in spite of the destructive drill that takes place in our secondary education, and especially in higher education, also make it possible for us to find our way back to any active forces remaining from our childhood and train ourselves to see the human being in this way. But placing the right value on a more subtle sculptural study of anatomy and physiology for medical students would do a lot to improve medical treatment as a whole for humankind. Illnesses that appear in the form of epidemics must also be considered in terms of their primary causes. The rhythm between head and chest, which has its crudest expression in the rhythm of respiration, is easily damaged in individuals who also tend to allow certain atmospheric or supra-earthly phenomena to influence them strongly. Others, whose respiratory system is healthily organized from the start, will tend to resist such influences. It is always possible for other disruptive causes to intervene, of course, but let me choose an example that will help us understand what this all depends on. Suppose that during a particular winter, the sun's activity, note that I said the sun's activity, not the effects of light, is strongly influenced by the outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Sun activity that can assert itself independently, because Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are at a distance, would have a different effect from this particular winter constellation. During a winter like this, we can notice that the atmospheric phenomena are different. In susceptible individuals, this has an unusually strong influence on the rhythmical activity taking place between the chest and the head, whose crudest expression is the rhythm of respiration. We can say that this constellation significantly strengthens the tendency to regularize this rhythm in people who were born in healthy circumstances and are internally robust, although outwardly, of course, they may be quite frail. In these people, respiratory rhythm is very strongly regulated, as is the general rhythm between the head and the chest. An internally reinforced rhythm such as this is not easily affected by outside influences, and severely damaging factors are required in order to influence it. An influence such as the one I described, however, has an exceptionally strong effect on people in whom this rhythm is irregular in some way, because an already damaged rhythm tends to permit further damage. All predisposed individuals who live on parts of the globe that are particularly affected by this heavenly constellation are candidates for so-called influenza. These influences absolutely must be present to lay the groundwork for an illness like influenza. In a different case, something more complicated is present. even though each individual rhythm is an independent entity, both the ongoing rhythm that finds its crudest expression in respiration and the rhythm influenced by sleeping and waking, human rhythmical activity as a whole is such that these rhythms, taken together, form a unity in the entire human rhythmic system. The lower rhythm may assert itself too strongly, relatively speaking, because the upper rhythm, the head-chest rhythm, is weakened. When the upper rhythm is too weak and deviates from its proper position, it is susceptible to being made even more irregular by the lower rhythm. In this case, the lower rhythm, which emanates from the activity of the spleen and from other organ activity that we will speak about later, works upward too strongly, creating the predisposition to hypertrophy of the upper digestive process with all its concomitant symptoms. Once again, a domain is created that especially favors the growth of certain lower organisms. The total picture that then appears is one of symptoms of inflammation and paralysis creeping into the upper organization, while the beginnings of organ malformations or new organic growths also appear there. In short, we have the symptomatology of diphtheria. I might call this, I might call this a breakthrough from below upward in the opposite direction from the breach that occurs in typhoid fever from above downward. This second type of breakthrough is essentially provoked by what I have just described. In all these issues, the age of the person in question must also be considered. During childhood, the entire interaction of the upper and lower parts of the human being, as well as the rhythmical activity that mediates between them, is totally different than it is in later life. In childhood, for example, the upper region of the human being must exert a much stronger influence on the lower region than is the case later on. In reality, children, quote-unquote, think much more than adults do. Strange as this may sound, it is nonetheless true. Instead of becoming conscious, children's thoughts simply go into the organism and appear in its growth and in the forms it is developing. This application of thought activity to the body's formative forces is especially pronounced in the first years of life. Once the body no longer needs to use so much of the formative forces for its own purposes, they are held back and become the force that forms the basis of memory. Therefore, memory appears only after the organism's demands on the formative forces are reduced, because the forces that underlie memory, on the organic level, are transformed forces of growth and development, which are especially called upon to shape the organism during the very first years of life. Everything is based on metamorphosis. When what we encounter on the mental or spiritual level is only the re-spiritualization of an activity that worked on a bodily level when spirit was moving into matter. This explains why children have strong forces of resistance to many abdominal symptoms. Heavenly factors, supra-earthly factors, appear principally in the abdomen. Here again, imagine that a strong reflection occurs in the human abdomen as the result of a particular supra-earthly constellation of the sun to other planets. What will the consequences be? There will be little effect on adults, in whom the rhythmical activity between the upper and lower parts of the body has already settled down to some extent. But children will have to forcefully resist the cosmic factor that wants to be reflected in the abdomen. And when a particular cosmic constellation affects a child's lower body very strongly, the upper body must resist exceptionally strongly. This convulsive, overly strong application of forces in the upper part of the children's bodies causes epidemic cerebrospinal meningitis. This process certainly provides insight into how outer, non-human nature sends these influences into the human being. I might say that if you take this as a background for your observations, you can paint a picture of the entire symptomatology of meningitis, right down to the stiffening of the neck muscles. Because of the exertion taking place in the upper part of the child's body, inflammatory symptoms must appear in the upper organs, in the meninges of the spinal cord or brain, which then result in the other symptoms. It is especially necessary to sharpen our eye for seeing the human being in the context not only of the interactions taking place between different parts of the body, but also of the interactions taking place between internal human factors and natural factors external to the human being, or even external to the earth. To my way of thinking, astrology in its present form is highly suspect, so of course I do not want to see it get out of hand as a result of views like this. It is enough to be aware of where such conditions come from, and we will indeed find this awareness necessary with regard to healing in particular. But it is really not so important to say that some illness or other is brought about by the quadrature of this star to that star. Under certain circumstances, this can be useful with regard to a cosmic diagnosis, but it is not the point. The point is to be able to heal. Tomorrow we will move on from today's considerations to the substances in outer non-human nature that have a defensive effect, that contain forces opposing what intrudes into the human organism in this way. In this context, recognition of the upper and lower areas of the human being really must assume more of a place in medical science, because in my opinion the strength of this recognition would enable physicians to collaborate in the interest of human health. When physicians specialize, they lose interest in the human being as a whole. I do not mean at all to say that physicians should not specialize. The techniques that appear over the course of time simply do bring about a certain degree of specialization. While this is happening, however, collaboration among specialists should also increase. This becomes evident when we consider pyrrhea, for example, which was mentioned in one of your questions. When it appears, we are dealing with not only a local problem, as many people believe, but with a predisposition, or worse, that involves the entire organism and is simply localized in the gums. For example, it would be very helpful if dentists who note the appearance of pyrrhea in their patients would make a habit of alerting other physicians to the fact that these people are likely candidates for diabetes. What we have already described to a certain extent as coming to expression in diabetes is easy to treat as long as it remains in its germinal stages in the upper part of the human being as pyrrhea. Much too little attention is paid to the fact that the lower part of the human being can overcome the upper, resulting in inappropriate impoverishment or enrichment of either the upper or the lower part. If the tendency to inflammation appears first in the upper region, the disease takes one form. If it appears in the lower part of the human being, it assumes the opposite or polar form of the illness. A very great deal depends on making this distinction. For this reason, it will also seem quite understandable that the etheric body, which contains all of an individual's forces for growth, must work differently during childhood than at a later age. In childhood, the etheric body must intervene in physical functioning to a much greater extent. It needs organs that provide it with direct points of contact. This is especially important during the fetal period, but it is still the case in the first stage of childhood, when both growth and form development are taking place, when sculptural forces need to take effect as growth continues. This is why we need organs such as the thymus gland, and to a certain extent also the thyroid gland, whose tasks are greater in childhood. Later these organs regress and may degenerate if physical forces take hold of them too strongly. Chemical activity within the organism simply must be stronger during childhood. Later this chemical activity tends to be replaced by the action of warmth. I might say that a change human beings undergo in the course of a lifetime is symbolized by the spectrum, or more than symbolized, if we look first at the more chemical portion of the spectrum, blue-violet, then at the light portion, green-yellow, and finally at the warmth portion, red. Human beings undergo a process of organization in this same direction, and there's a drawing. In childhood, we are more dependent on chemical action, but then we move on to light action, and later to the effects of warmth. The organs that make it possible for the etheric body to promote chemical activity in the physical body are glands such as the thyroid, thymus, and adrenals. Because these organs are in some way bound to chemical activity, the flesh tones of human skin are related to their activity, that is, to the underlying etheric activity, to a great extent. One of the effects of the adrenals, for example, is to make a person either pale or red-cheeked, and so on. Adrenal degeneration has to be expressed in the coloration of the skin. To see deeply into these connections, simply recall that patients with so-called Addison's disease, which is due to adrenal degeneration, turn brown. This points toward a certain chemical activity in the organism. It is especially relevant to the fetal period, while the action of light comes into consideration more in life after the age of about 14. Later still, we move more into the action of warmth. All this constitutes an important indication with regard to the course of an individual's life. Childhood, especially the fetal period, represents a preponderance of the salt process, while the middle portion of life, that is still somewhat closer to childhood, represents a mercurial process of sorts, and later life a sulfur process, in the context I have just described. In childhood, we must pay the most attention to the salt process, in midlife to the mercurial process, and at a later age to the sulfur-like or phosphorus-like process, regulating each in its turn. If you look at the fact that the human organism also includes the trinity of organized chemical activity, an organized light process, and an organized warmth process, that is, organized salt, mercury, and sulfur processes, you will also get an idea of how life as a whole organizes the human being. In the child, lifestyle, by which I mean not merely nutrition, but everything the person does, works through chemical activity, intervening strongly within the organism. In the very young person, the light process, which I might say is stronger, intervenes in the entire organism in a way that can also sow the seeds of psychological disturbances of all sorts, because adolescents are most susceptible to impressions of the outer world. Whether the outer life that enters us strongly at this age is built up logically or illogically is of great importance for our entire soul constitution in later life. We will continue talking about these questions tomorrow. In particular, we will move on from the pathological aspects we have discussed today to therapeutic aspects. The end of Lecture 18.